Hi, it's Anne Strainchamps. I was in Vermont recently visiting my family, and one of the pleasures of being there is my dad's book collection. He's got shelves and shelves of first editions, modern firsts. That's what he collects. But the thing about his books is that he doesn't read those first editions. I mean, he reads the books, but what he does is he buys the first edition, puts it on the shelf, and then he goes to the library and borrows a copy to read. And I was thinking, what is that about? There's something sort of wonderful and a little crazy about that. So this hour, on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, The Art of Collecting. For example, take 78 RPM 78s, records that are so old, there are hardly even any machines left to play them on. Some of the oldest and rarest were made in Grafton, Wisconsin, just down the road a piece from us. And the thing is, they made them just to throw in as kind of freebies with their phonograph cabinets. But they just happened to record some of the earliest blues music in American history. And so for collectors, these old 78s are legendary.
And for years, there were these rumors that when the Paramount Records pressing plant in Grafton shut down, when everybody was laid off, the employees were so aggravated and so upset that they hurled all the dead stock records, so all the records that had been pressed but hadn't been sent out for distribution yet, they just frisbeed them into the Milwaukee River. So collectors would talk often about how, that's why Paramounts were so rare, because they were all rotting away at the bottom of the river.
That's Amanda Petrasich. She discovered 78s when she was working on a story about collectors, and she kind of got bitten by the collecting bug herself.
So I'd been hearing those rumors, and I found out that there had been a show on PBS called The History Detectives who had sent a scuba team into the Milwaukee River to look for the records. They didn't come up with anything, and I watched the episode, and I thought, oh, my God, that's fascinating. And then I just started thinking, like, well, they didn't do it right.
Left a bit last night and four flowers in my feet. I went to bed last night and I was in my feet.
No, I had no idea how to scuba dive. I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to jump in the Milwaukee River. I thought it would be quite a bit simpler than it turned out to be. Learning to scuba dive, I am a runner, but I am not really an athletic person. I have no interest in extreme sports. I'm not really so into the ocean.
Hey, mama, tell me what have I? Tell me what have I? Feel love. Hey, mama, tell me what have I done?
We did the dive in July, which is one of the only times you can dive in the Milwaukee River without having to wear a dry suit because the water's usually so cold. And a dry suit complicates the whole process even more. But we were wearing wetsuits, and I remember standing at the side of the road in Grafton, and I'm changing into my wetsuit. And there's cars driving by on their ways to, their way to work, and they're just looking out the window. And I could just, some of them were honking. I could see on their faces, like, what in God's name is that person doing? Why is she changing into scuba, like putting an oxygen tank, changing into scuba gear the side of this river? But I did end up jumping in the river, which was very scary, and kind of very shallow in that particular stretch, but also runs very fast. So I would sort of get in there and I would fall over just by the force of the water. Dug around for a while, swam around for a while. We did find some bits of machinery that seemed as if they were inevitably kind of part of the old pressing plant, but we did not find any Paramount records. And I remember getting out of the water and just thinking, like, of course you didn't, Amanda.
Amanda did not find any Paramount records that day, but she did find something else. The whole crazy, weird world of collecting. This hour, we're talking about the obsessive longing that drives people to collect things. Compulsively. For example, Amanda wound up writing an entire book about 78 collectors, people like John Hennigan.
He was the first person that I spoke to about collecting who framed it as a disease. I mean, I remember sitting in his apartment and him saying, like, this is sick, we're all sick. And he also talked about it, and these were two things that ended up kind of defining my research on the topic for the next couple of years. He also talked about it as a kind of addiction, that you're always looking for the next hit. It's never enough. you know, you never sort of reach the end of the line and say, I've got it, the collection's perfect, it's complete. You always want more. You know, the more you have, the more you want.
And so one of the first 78s you listened to with him was Mississippi John Hurt's Big Leg Blues.
Yes.
Yeah. What was that like?
You know, he dropped that needle into groove, and I just remember just sort of feeling like, this is very dramatic, but feeling like my insides dissolve. I mean, I felt closer to that song than I'd ever felt before. It just, there was something, and I don't know whether it's necessarily the fidelity of the recording or just the sort of ritual and the experience or the proximity to something rare and beautiful and unusual, but it just, it sounded closer to me. It sounded more intimate. I just remember thinking like, oh no, you know, I'm down the rabbit hole now. Like there's no coming back from this.
Hennigan also had this holy grail
He'd
been looking for a while. It's a copy of Skip James' Devil Got My Woman, which is a recording so legendary. It had this kind of mystical aura.
Whenever I think of Devil Got My Woman, I think of that movie that Terry Zwigoff wrote and directed, Ghost World, starring Steve Buscemi, who plays a 78 collector. It's sort of one of the only depictions of 78 collectors in all of cinema, I think. And he plays that record for his sort of young protege, a character named Enid, who's played by Thora Birch. And the record finishes playing, and she says to him, I want to hear more records like that. And he sort of gives her a look, and there's a pause and says, there aren't any more records like that. Mm. And I think Devil Got My Woman is a particular example of something that just sounds so kind of ghostly and strange and singular. And I could understand why a guy like John would come to be sort of both obsessed and possessed by it. I mean, it just drove so much of his collecting, his desire to kind of get his hands on that thing that was so strange and so affecting.
It's almost like being possessed.
Yeah.
And in fact, didn't Hennigan tell you that there were times when he dreamed about finding records?
Yes. Yeah. He told me he would dream about finding a record and would wake up. And anyone who's had a really great or really terrible dream knows that moment where you wake up and it sort of takes you a half a second to realize that you were dreaming. And he would dream often about thinking that he had Devil Got My Woman. He told me it would even get so bad that he would wake up and then would get up and go check his shelves to sort of make sure it wasn't there, you know, because he wanted so badly to believe that he'd found a copy of that record, of which I think there are only maybe two or three extant copies in the world. So the chances of him achieving that dream are pretty slim.
Amanda Petrusich. Her book about 78 collectors is called Do Not Sell at Any Price. And hey, if she made you want to hear more of those old Paramount records, we made you a playlist. You'll find it on our website at ttbook.org. So ask anybody who collects anything what their best thing is, the most prized item in their collection. It's always the rarest, right? The most unusual, the one of a kind. But why? So let's go back to the early history of collecting. More than 300 years ago, Peter the Great, the emperor of all Russia, built one of the most famous collections in the world, his Kunstkamera, or Chamber of Wonders. And he filled it with freaks, four-legged roosters, two-headed sheep, jars of deformed fetuses. This sounds gross, but this is the kind of thing that was a fad in 1700s Europe, especially among the founding fathers of Western science. Science historian Lorraine Datsun told Steve Paulson why.
They were interested in monsters. Let's take the case of Bacon. Let's be concrete about this.
Francis Bacon.
They were interested in exceptions to the rule. So one has to remember, keep in mind, that the 16th and 17th centuries were times of extraordinary social, religious, political, economic, and intellectual upheaval. From both the Far East and the Far West, Europe was being deluged with novelties of all kinds. animals that no one could possibly have imagined, birds of paradise, armadillos. It was also being disrupted by novelties on the religious front, and monsters were part of a canon of portents that were supposed to foretell the apocalypse. And it was also a time of intellectual, what we would now call revolution. Copernicus published his book on the solar system in 1543. In that very same year, Andreas Vesalius published his book on the anatomy of the human body. This produced a consciousness in the minds of thinking Europeans in the early 17th century that the ground upon which they stood was extremely unstable. Everything was changing at once. It also produced a consciousness in people like Bacon that it was possible, this was unthinkable, but it was just possible that the very best minds for the last two millennia had been dead wrong about everything.
It sounds like you're saying that there is a connection between how to explain these marvels, these wonders, these anomalies, and the emergence of science.
Yes, that is what I'm saying, particularly in the writings of someone like Bacon or even Descartes. These are seen as challenges. These are gauntlets thrown down. So one has to think of the 17th century as a time of competition, fierce competition between lots of rival theories of everything. It was pretty clear to those who were in the know that Aristotelian natural philosophy was doomed on many fronts. The question was, what was going to succeed it? And there were lots of competitors in this race to figure out who was going to succeed natural philosophy. And what the marvels did, not only monsters, but other kinds of marvels, did was to offer a kind of extreme case. Can your natural, your new reformed natural philosophy explain this? So that was one use of monsters, which made them more prominent in the late 16th and early 17th centuries than they've ever been either before or after in the history of science. Anomalies were very briefly center stage. So when we think about the ancestors of our museums, the cabinets of curiosity, the Wunderkammer, they are chock full of marvels and monsters of all kinds. Now, some of them are things that we would not consider so marvelous. So, for example, paper money from China. We have long accustomed ourselves to paper money. But from the standpoint of a late 16th century European, that people would accept paper money instead of gold or silver was almost as much of a marvel as an armadillo.
Let me ask you about these Wunderkammern, which are, now this is in English, this word is usually translated as cabinets of curiosities, but isn't actually the better translation cabinets of wonder?
Yes, that would be the better. That was a chamber of wonders, I guess, would be the most literal translation.
Is that distinction important? I mean, do wonder and curiosity mean the same thing?
No, they don't, although it's also distinctive about this period that wonder and curiosity, which before and to some extent after really exist apart, are yoked together. So I'll just give you an example about the pre-modern, before the 16th century. So wonder is a cognitive emotion. That is, you've got to register some kind of anomaly. And in order to register an anomaly, you've got to know something about the order which the anomaly breaches. And Aristotle says, in wonder is the beginning of philosophy. But he's very firm, as are all of his medieval followers, that the beginning is not the middle or the end. The aim of an Aristotelian natural philosophy was to make wonder disappear as soon as possible. It was a sign that you were ignorant at very best, and at worst, it was a sign that you were timorous, that you were fearful. Curiosity was associated, since ancient times, was actually a vice rather than a virtue. It was associated with people who meddled in other people's business. Hmm. So first and foremost, butting into your neighbor's business, mm-hmm. but also meddling into secrets, for example, the secrets of nature, the secrets of God, which the secrets of the prince, which did not concern you.
And well, of course, the classic example is Adam and Eve, the original sin, you know, which
right.
resulted
Absolutely.
From curiosity.
Exactly. And what happens in the 16th and 17th century is fascinating. First of all, for curiosity, curiosity goes from being a real vice to a virtue. It becomes a form of audacity. And wonder goes from being a sign of ignorance to being a sign of avidity, of desire for knowledge. And perhaps the clearest expression of this is in Descartes' treatise on the passions, where he says, first wonder is engaged and then curiosity is engaged. And the two work together. Wonder is like the spark that ignites the fuse of curiosity. And then curiosity marshals the intellect and all of the senses to the quest until we found the cause of the wonder.
Hmm. Well, tell me more about these Wunderkammer and these cabinets of wonders. What kinds of things did people collect?
What didn't they collect? Well, first of all, in order to qualify for the Wunderkammer, you have to be unusual in some respect. So the objects could be unusual because they're exotic. So paper money from China or pointed toed slippers from Turkey. Or they could be wondrous because they are mistakes of nature. So two-headed snakes, for example. Or they could be wondrous because they are virtuoso works of art, 1,000 faces carved upon one cherry stone. And then the ways in which they're displayed is to accentuate the sort of hodgepodgery of it all. They're displayed next to one another in order to accentuate diversity, miscellany, and also plenitude. Perhaps you've seen pictures of these floor-to-ceiling plastered Wunderkammer, which have everything from shields from Ceylon to a stuffed Laplander to a crocodile hanging from the ceiling. The aim of a Wunderkammer, especially a Wunderkammer of a prince, was to overwhelm you, to open your eyes, open your mouth, leave you frozen with wonder. And the reason they were often shown to ambassadors at princely courts in the early modern period was to impress the ambassador with the power and the numinousness of the prince whose court he was visiting. So they were instrumental in a kind of power display.
Well, it also sounds like that these cabinets of wonder were in some ways the forerunners of today's museums.
They were. Absolutely. They were. You know, it's really interesting to think about what kinds of emotions museums these days are meant to provoke. And they have a lot in common with those early modern Wunderkammer. They're, first of all, meant to astonish us. They're meant to jolt us out of our everyday habits of thought. Fancy seeing that. And then they're meant to provoke our curiosity. They're meant to make us inquisitive about this new class of objects. So, yes, probably only in museums is that very productive alliance of wonder and curiosity preserved at full intensity.
And yet, on the other hand, from our perspective, from our modern perspective, this strange mix of man-made objects, sort of these weird curiosities often from other parts of the world, and then the oddities of nature. It was as if there wasn't any clear distinction between nature and art, and that distinction seems so obvious to us today.
You know, it would have been obvious also to, say, the 14th and 15th century. And it's really interesting what happens in the early modern period. It goes back to what we were talking about a moment ago, namely that these monsters and other marvels are being used as a kind of catalyst to accelerate new theories of knowledge. And the idea is, and this is again Bacon's formulation, from the wonders of nature is the nearest passage to the wonders of art. And what he means by that is that what these monsters are, what these marvels are experiments that nature is performing on herself. And if we, for example, want to create a new way of tempering steel or a new way of dyeing fabric, we should look very, very closely at these experiments that nature is performing on the margins, as it were, of the regular order of nature, and then imitate nature in that respect.
And I mean, the other thing that's so curious about this from today's perspective is that we collect objects of nature and art we categorize them in entirely different ways, and we put them in different kinds of museums. I mean, you know, paintings and sculptures go into an art museum, and seashells and animals go into a natural history museum. But those distinctions apparently were not made in these Wunderkammer, these cabinets of wonder.
No, on the contrary, it was, as I say, all one great, glorious miscellany. And I think you can date the end of the Age of Wonder precisely by that division of labor between two different kinds of museums, art museums and natural history museums.
Lorraine Dastin is a science historian at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. She's the author of Wonders and the Order of Nature. You can read more of that conversation with Steve in Nautilus magazine. The link is on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Don't go away. Coming up, what would you put in a cabinet of curiosity today? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. More than 60 years ago, the artist Natasha Nicholson started bringing home curiosities, strange objects she found or bought just because they fascinated her. Things like skulls and old coins, broken dolls, seashells, strings of beads. And she started making arrangements of these things, mounting them in frames and then handmade boxes. And then she began building cabinets of curiosity. And all the time, these collections kept growing to the point that they began spilling out onto the walls and the tables and the floors of her home and her studio. And today, she kind of lives inside her own curated cabinet of curiosity, which is now the subject of a one-woman exhibition at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art.
Natasha, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent, excellent.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much. I was just saying, like, being here again reminds me I need to lead a more extraordinary life. I was looking you up online, and I saw a couple pieces that I love, I remembered from here that I loved.
Oh, yeah, here they are.
Yeah, Charles Monroe Kane lives in the same neighborhood as Natasha Nicholson. Her home and studios are in an old storefront, which just happens to be right next door to one of his favorite dive bars. So for years, Charles has been walking home at night and stopping to stare at the weird and wonderful objects in Natasha's windows, which it turns out is what a lot of the other bar patrons were doing too.
At bar time at night, and in this room particularly, the conversations should have been taped. Somebody's had a few drinks, they come along and say, what is this stuff? Somebody say, I think it's art. And they say, I don't like art, but I really like this stuff. I wonder, what is this stuff? And it goes on and on like that. So the conversations, when they don't know somebody's on the other side of these curtains.
Yeah.
And so they are free to speak in a way that they'd be intimidated if they walk into a museum. And that's one of the reasons I like being on the street, is that museums, by virtue of many issues, can be intimidating to some people. But when they're on the street and with their friends and feeling not on view, they will say things they wouldn't say in a museum. And sometimes it's really interesting. I've met great friends from people knocking on the door because I like that ability to appeal to people without definition or prior preconceptions, but just to let them absorb what they're seeing and change their mind. You know, I don't like art, but I like this. I mean, that's a wonderful statement.
How do you discern when a find, there's so many objects and things in the world, how do you discern that that find is yours?
Pure instinct. The things talk to me. That's what a lot of people don't understand. Mm-hmm. In order to make this kind of work, or I think any work, you have to listen to what the objects are telling you. They give me as much information as I give them.
Is that a conversation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It happens all the time. And so that's what I do. I listen to what these things tell me. Perrault in this piece. These are early photographs, probably late 19th century. But they all relate to something we know somewhere in our minds. And I think the best art is about memory. And it's not just about my memory. It's about what the visitor, the viewer, what they conjure in their own mind about what these objects mean to them, which are totally different than mine, and that's the way it should be.
Oh, look at that. Look how cool that is.
Those are beautiful. Those are 19th century slates from a roof. And you couldn't do a painting that beautiful as each one of those. It would take years and years and decades, a lifetime, to learn how to paint like that. I mean, they resemble Rothko's.
Isn't that beautiful?
Now, the cabinets, this is a cabinet of sorts. Maybe sure. This is one of the first cabinets I ever did. I went to Europe for the first time when I was 32. And I built these three-room pieces, perhaps 40 inches long, and they're divided into three sections, and you're looking into individual rooms that then make up some kind of space. Now, that space could be many different things. And for me, it is a living space, but it's been altered. And with the found objects, these beautiful pins that were used in some kind of electronic process that probably cost thousands of dollars to make. They're salmon pink with a tiny little glass bead on the end. And chairs, which are a constant in my work. And then the last panel on this one is a secret, so you can only see through the end of it. The last room is entirely clad in galvanized metal with a bed and nothing else. So it becomes interpretive. You interpret it to be whatever you want with the story that's going on your head. It takes the artist a long time to understand what they're doing. So often people ask, well, what does this mean? I'll say, I don't know. I haven't lived with it long enough. And it's like maturing and growing. You say, wow, that's where I was at that time. I understand what this means. You can't always understand at the moment.
You say you rearrange this sometimes.
Things keep moving.
Are you arranging and rearranging this work?
All the time. And that's part of the power of what I do. It's all changing all the time. And this is rather what I call my tinder cabinet. There are things that I love in here that are small. I love small things. And the arrangement, the contradiction, the empty photo albums, you know, what lives lived in those albums at one time. And this beautiful bronze silvered eagle that's sort of a little fierce looking in comparison to the tenderness of these. It's that contrast that I like. The glass, the humor of the glass, this glass man, this figure with a clown's hat could be very trite without the elegance of these older pieces of glass that are gilded and beautiful and hand-blown and about another time. So there's the constant contrast. And one of the reasons for the colors in the pale greens, the reds, the yellows, the mauves, is that when cabinets started, people lived in darkness. So I did a lot of research, and cabinets were shockingly pink and bright yellow because you could see objects against them. If they were against wood, dark wood, which this cabinet was before I put this paper in it, you wouldn't be able to see anything. And in the times that cabinets came into being, you wouldn't have seen anything at all. And it was important to know, because these things that were marvels, when, you know, a seashell to some people was a miraculous thing.
Right, of course, yeah.
Things that we take for granted, the whole idea of wonder, of the glory of an object, and the excitement of an object that one hadn't seen before.
Cabinets caress your back. Young people are making them. Why? The age of the internet. I don't get it. Like, you think you could see anything you want, right?
I think it has to do with the physicality of it and your closeness to it. You're not just looking at a picture. A picture can give you information, but in a lot of cases, if it's not installed in the proper way, this makes something happen to your mind, your body, your heart, everything. Your flesh. I mean, there's things I get where I get goosebumps. And people who look at it get goosebumps. And I think that you need that physicality of it. The internet can tell us a lot, but it's not physical.
It also seems like there's a care in here for the negative space and for what you're doing.
I love manipulating space, and I understand space. So it's making that magic. And cabinets are magic. And I think people respond to the magic. But the magic has to appear effortless. For my work to be successful, you can't see how it's done. It just appears that way. And that's what magic is. You got to get rid of the strings.
You're 70 years old. You've been doing this for a long time. Mm-hmm. There must have been a moment where this was your choice. You're like, I'm going to do this.
Oh,
well,
very early.
Take me back to that.
Very early. When I was a child and one of six children, where space was always at a premium, I always had my set spaces, and no one touched them. By my bedside, I had a small table. an implied box. It had parameters. And my treasures would go on there. And at an early age, those treasures could be rocks or a dried flower or a postcard from the art museum or something that had no value. But how it was arranged was incredibly important to me. I always had to have a certain order of some things. To this day, if I really love something, it either stays on my side of the bed or my bedside table for months sometimes before I can let it go out into another space.
Whenever I see a cabinet of curiosity, certainly yours, which are absolutely lovely, I think that one of the words that comes to mind, and I hate it because it's a negative word, but is obsession. Oh. It seems like the artist is obsessed. Are you obsessed?
Any good collector is obsessed. If you're not obsessed, you're not a great collector, because you're always looking for the next high. You're always looking for the next buy. You're always looking, how can I afford it? I'm buying it on time. Oh my God, I missed that piece. I made a terrible mistake. I should have, you know, sold 10 things in order to get that. Of course I'm obsessed.
That's Natasha Nicholson talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Her new solo show reproduces her entire studio space inside the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. If you can't get here to see it, you can also read a new coffee table book called Natasha Nicholson, The Artist in Her Museum, or just visit our website and see a slideshow of her work. That's ttbook.org.
When I was a kid, my parents were big antique hunters, and so they started me collecting this glass called Blue Bubble. It was a Depression glass, and I started collecting it when I was 5. And years ago, I stopped buying it, but I still have an aunt who, for the last 30 years, for birthdays and Christmas and special occasions, has been sending me pieces. So it's really a special thing to me. My brother collected baseball cards, and he has boxes and boxes and boxes, which are stacked in my parents' basement right now.
I collect action figures, Star Wars, anything Marvel, DC, and G.I. Joe. Definitely got the whole Star Wars universe in my closet. Started with my dad when he was a kid, and he kind of just passed it all to me. So, early 70s, even though I was born in the 90s.
I still have a beer can collection from the 1970s. I think I might still have a full six-pack of Billy Beer.
I have a friend who went to the new Glarus Beer, Cheese, and Bacon Fest a couple of months ago, and there was a booth that was selling these really cool wood cutouts of either the United States or of Wisconsin, and then you could put these little bottle caps in it. So she bought the Wisconsin one for her stepdad, and he's only filling it with Wisconsin beer bottle caps, and then she got the United States one, so her and her boyfriend, now that they've just moved into a new apartment, are going to try and get bottle caps from every state in the United States.
I've made some attempt to collect bells, so like collectible bells you find at like the airports or whatever, odd stuff like that.
Baseball cards, stamps, as a young person. It was fun doing it.
And then after a while, you know, with a collection, you just keep going and going and going.
All right, so what do you collect? This week, I discovered that I have coworkers who collect board games, cassette tapes, obscure musical instruments, and beer cans. And then one of my neighbors knocked on my door the other night to show me his collection of early Wonder Woman comics. Seems like once you start asking, you find out that just about everybody collects something.
I've collected a lot of things across my life, but I can't think of another type of object that pulls together the loose threads of sociology and art history and material science and technology in such a complete way as buttons do.
Gary Brockman collects buttons, old 19th century buttons.
Early 90s, I was working in publishing in New York, and long story short, I needed some buttons for a workshop we were going to do with science teachers, and did the workshop. There happened to be two people who were button collectors in that group of science teachers, and once the buttons went out on the table, the science portion of the workshop was over for them. I just sidled around to where they were owing and awing over them and asked them what was going on. And they told me they were button collectors and these were really wonderful buttons. And I asked them if they would stay around after the workshop ended and just tell me about them. And they did. And I was hooked from that point on. Button collecting has had a couple of different iterations. It was very popular during the Victorian era. As an organized hobby in the United States, it really dates back to the late 1930s. The publisher of Hobbies Magazine in Chicago was instrumental in putting together a group of people who wanted to form a national button society, which still exists and which every few years has its national convention here in Wisconsin, usually in Appleton. It caught on very quickly. World War II pretty much interrupted the development of the organization of the hobby, but once the war ended, there were chapters, state chapters, that started up all over the U.S. and local chapters, many of which are still in operation, still very active. We've just come off of a run of 8 shows in 11 weeks in 8 different states, so there are still many people who collect buttons and shows that specialize strictly in buttons and button-related materials. There's actually a taxonomy for button collectors. There's a committee and an annual meeting and a lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes into studying buttons and classifying them by material, by use, by pictorial subject. And every summer at the National Button Show, there are competitions in most of those classification areas, who can put together the best tray of shell buttons using the taxonomy for shell, who can put together the best plastic buttons. I think buttons matter in the way that any material from any culture at any point in history matters. They're windows into our past. You know, there's that really tired old saying, those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. And this is just one more avenue into human history, into cultural history, into technological history. You've got it all right here. You can see the development of artistic styles. You can see the development of manufacturing techniques. Everything is connected to everything else.
Gary Brockman lives in Middleton, Wisconsin, and he collects 19th century buttons. I'm Ann Strainchamps. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll talk politics. President Obama's chief campaign strategist, David Axelrod, joins us to tell us why, even after years of enduring bitter partisan fighting and bickering, he is still a political idealist. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. As we gear up for the new campaign season, we've been thinking about what it takes to elect a president. So we asked one of the modern campaign masters, David Axelrod. It was his social media strategy that swept Barack Obama into office in 2008. And Axelrod was in town recently, stopped by our studio to talk about the art of the presidential campaign. Steve Paulson wondered, which is more fun, being president or running for president?
Running is fun. And I remember when we began the campaign in 2007. And one of the first things that Senator Obama said to us was, this ought to be fun. He said, you know, this is a deadly, serious pursuit. We're trying to change the world here. But that should be fun. It should be exhilarating. We should have a good time. And we did.
I want to come back to something that you just said about how exhilarating running a campaign is. I mean, you've written about how it's not just exhilarating, it's addictive. And to the point where the addiction becomes a little dangerous.
Yeah, I think so. It was one of the reasons why I resolved before the 2012 campaign that it would be my last, because every one of them takes something out of you. One of the things I wrote about in my book was the sacrifices my family had to make.
You were never around.
Because I was never around. I was. Yeah, and you always rationalize it because it's the ultimate existential rush, right? You're headed toward this finite deadline. You either win or you lose, and you can justify almost anything in pursuit of that goal.
Let's talk a little bit about that first campaign for president, historic campaign. a number of things that are very memorable. One was the slogan, "Yes, we can."
Yes.
Which you came up with.
I did. It actually, that slogan was first employed in the campaign for the Senate in 2004, which was the first campaign on which I actually worked with him. You know, I really loved it because our campaign was about involving large numbers of people in the movement for change. We wanted them to feel that it was about all of us and not just about Barack Obama. And we wanted them to feel optimistic that there were that we could change things. And so the first time we ever used the line was in the first commercial I ever did for him. And I will always remember this. He read the script through the first time, and it cataloged all these improbable things that he was able to accomplish in his life, barriers he overcame. And he said, "Now they say we can't change Washington. I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message to say, yes, we can." And he got to the end of the ad, and he said, "Yes, we can. Is that too corny?" And my heart stopped, and I'm making the case for why it's not. And Michelle was sitting on the steps watching him film his first ad. And he turned to her and he said, "Mish, what do you think?" And she just kind of slowly shook her head and said, "Not corny."
Now, another thing about the 2008 campaign is your campaign mastered new media in a way that had never really been done before. I mean, you somehow managed to target very specific groups of voters. What was the breakthrough there for you?
Well, first of all, had it not been for social media and the technology that was emerging at that time, Barack Obama could not have run for president. You know, when we met to discuss the possibility of his running for president in 2006, late 2006, there were only eight people in the room, and that was the entire Obama for America organization nationwide. And two of them were Barack and Michelle, so technically there were six of us. But what we had was a faith that there were people who shared his sensibilities about the need for change, who would respond through social media, and that we could reach them through social media. We had seen—
Are you talking Facebook in particular?
We're talking about email. We're talking about Facebook. We're talking about meetups. I should point out that in 2012, we knew going into 2012 that what we had done in 2008 was almost prehistoric, the way all of this technology churns. And
So that was a totally different campaign by 2012?
The real addition in 2012 that made a huge difference was the addition of analytics and big data. We hired 54 young analytic geeks who were in this windowless part of the campaign headquarters staring at their computer screens, but they did extraordinary things in terms of helping us identify, particularly in the battleground states. We developed profiles of 36 million voters and made suppositions as to who was certainly going to be for us, who was almost certainly going to be against us, and who the marginal voters were.
You're talking about specific people.
Specific people, yes.
Wow.
So that gave us an enormous advantage in terms of how we targeted our resources. And we also created mobile tools for people who are out in the field so they could know, don't knock on that door, that guy's never going to be for us, but this is a possibility and these people really care about the environment, so be prepared. You know,
So don't just go knocking on every door. That's old school.
Right. I mean, you know, the thing is that in a campaign, there's always going to be a group of people who are against you, and there's always going to be a group of people who will be with you through thick and thin. And the art of winning campaigns, particularly in these battleground states, is getting to those marginal voters and trying to persuade them.
Let me follow up on the 2012 campaign, mm-hmm. the first debate with Mitt Romney, which was a disaster for Obama. I mean, he got trounced there.
I think that's generally understood.
What happened?
What happened was what we feared might happen, because it was common to every incumbent president. Bill Clinton escaped it in 96, but basically every incumbent president has had a bad to disastrous first debate. And I think there are reasons for it. President hasn't debated in 4 years. The opponent generally has come through a primary and is in battle trim. President is not used to having someone 4 feet away from them.
Who's basically your peer in that situation.
Exactly. And most presidents don't like to be poked and prodded and challenged in the way that you get challenged in debates. And so, you know, we went through debate preps starting months in advance, and they were uneven, to say the least. So we were, the night before the the first debate in Denver, we had a really rough run-through. And I actually had a really rough conversation with the president after the run-through in which he said, oh, I thought that was pretty solid. And I told him the truth, and he was very unhappy about that. It was probably the sharpest exchange we've ever had. But it was sharp because I think he knew the truth, which was he wasn't particularly emotionally and prepared for this debate.
So you went into the first debate kind of thinking he wasn't going to do well.
Oh, I think we all had real sense of foreboding. And it didn't help that when David Plouffe and I went into the locker room before the debate, because it was in an arena, the president said, let's just get this over with. Now, understand, in 2008, this was a guy who, before the first debate with John McCain, I said, how do you feel? He said, just give me the ball. And now he was saying, let's just get this over with. These are not the words you want to hear from your candidate going into a major debate. It was a nightmare. And, you know, I had to go into that spin room where all the reporters hang out afterwards and try and spin the unspinnable and say why it wasn't a disaster. And I've never been so happy to walk out of a building as I was that building that night.
So what changed then by the second debate where Obama did quite well?
It took him a while to grasp how bad that debate was. But once he did, he totally owned it and said, I'm going to do better. And he...
Because he came across that first one as kind of standoffish,
right,
and like he wasn't willing
to engage.
Well, here's
the thing. So we had a bad run through again 36 hours before the second debate, and we were really in a state of panic. And we met with the president the next morning, just a few of us. It was kind of an intervention. And he was very candid. He said, look, you know, I was trained as a lawyer. I tend to treat these things like contests of fact and so on. And I know it's not, you know.
It's a performance.
It's a performance. But he doesn't like the performance elements of it. He thinks it's artificial. He thinks it's demeaning. But once we had that discussion, he came back into the prep. You know, he did everything that he needed to do. And when we were leaving, he said to Plouffe me. He actually called us in. He said, I just want you guys to know I think we prepared well for this one. And we're going to have a good night.
So you felt pretty good going
into that one. He did. He did. And after the first 5 minutes, we knew. Because here's the thing, when you're preparing someone for a debate, if you're well prepared, if the candidate's well prepared, you're never surprised. You hear a question comes up, you know how the candidate's going to handle that question. If you don't know how the candidate's going to handle that question, you probably haven't prepared well. So everybody breathed a sigh of relief after like the first 5 minutes, whereas in the first debate, after the first 5 minutes, we were all under our desks.
Mm. Now, one of the things that's kind of off-putting for a lot of people, a lot of Americans, is these presidential campaigns go on forever. I mean, at least 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, really longer, as opposed to, say, in the UK. It's
right.
A matter of weeks
right.
to the, elect a prime minister.
Yes.
Do we need such a long campaign?
Well, the reason that these campaigns are so long has everything to do with money. They are so costly now that in order to raise the money that you need, you have to start years in advance.
Is that bad for us, though?
Well, I think the money is bad for us. That's without question. And I think the length of the process is bad because now we have basically wall-to-wall elections with a few weeks of governing wedged between them. But the one virtue of the long campaign is that it is more than ever a gauntlet. You do find out who people are. I said in 2011 before that campaign that presidential campaigns are like MRIs for the soul, that whoever you are, by the end of it, people know.
So in other words, you have to be made of tough stuff to
you do,
to,
and
to
you and
withstand
I, but
this.
And I don't think you can hide who you are. I mean, whoever you are, people get a sense of it by the end of them.
Hmm. I have a personal question for you. My 19-year-old daughter absolutely loves the old TV show West Wing.
Yes,
she's seen it many times, the
yes.
whole thing.
It's interesting because, you know, I run this Institute of Politics at the University uh-huh. of Chicago, and those kids have West Wing nights.
Oh, really?
And they go watch. We actually brought in some of the writers and stars of the West Wing to talk to them about the show.
Huh. So her dream is she would love to be able to work with those kinds of people, you know, with that president in that show,
yeah.
the political operatives there. And my fatherly advice is, that world doesn't exist. That's fiction.
Well,
you know,
look,
I mean, yeah, of course there are idealists, but, you know, it's like given the grind of politics, the compromises, it doesn't seem like that exists. Am I too cynical?
Yeah, I think you are too cynical. And I think it's important that we not send that message because Congress is going to meet with you or without you. They're going to make decisions that impact every equity that you care about, whether it's human rights or cost of education or war and peace. And you don't want to leave those decisions to others. You want to try and influence those decisions and be decision makers.
I mean, someone's going to take those roles. But the question is, does idealism kind of go out the window?
You know, I worked in a White House in which I saw a president make a number of decisions that were as unpopular as they were necessary, who thought about the long run, sometimes at a short-term political risk to himself. And I actually had my idealism redeemed through that experience. So I don't think it's necessarily so that you have to be a cynic to survive. The only thing I'd say about the West Wing is, you know, nobody is as smart and quick and witty as Aaron Sorkin's characters. I mean, I worked with some really smart people in the White House, but it wasn't like we were in a constant state of witty repartee. So that part of it is probably more fiction than fact.
I'm a living sunset, lightning in my bones. It pushed me to the edge, but my will is strong. 'Cause I believe in a better way.
David Axelrod, talking with Steve Paulson. Axelrod was the chief strategist for Barack Obama's presidential campaigns. Today, he runs the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of a memoir called Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show, with help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Special thanks to producers Erica Janik and Emma Ruskowski. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. See you next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.